Ian Nisbet, an earth scientist at Royal Holloway, University of London, told Nature that methane levels are growing dangerously fast as powerful countries around the world refuse to end the extraction of coal, natural gas, and other sources of the pollutant. Is warming feeding the warming? It's an incredibly important question, said Nisbet, adding as yet no answer, but it very much looks that way. Scientists have long feared that the continued burning of fossil fuels risks setting in motion a chain reaction whose consequences, particularly ever more global warming, are irreversible. While researchers are still working to discern the extent to which human activity is responsible for the alarming spike in atmospheric methane levels in recent years, scientists have previously warned against categorizing certain causes of methane emissions, such as thawing permafrost, as natural, given that they are typically a result of human-driven warming. Regardless of how this mystery plays out, humans are not off the hook, Nature stressed recently, adding, based on their latest analysis of isotopic trends, NOAA scientist Shin Lan's team estimates that fossil fuel extraction accounted for about 62% of total methane emissions since from 2007 to 2016. NOAA's latest figures were released months after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, warned in its 2021 landmark report that atmospheric methane levels are currently higher than at any point in the last 800,000 years. Despite such a dire finding, global policymakers took few steps to substantively address methane emissions at COP26 Climate Summit in November. While dozens of additional countries signed on to a pledge to reduce methane emissions by 30% from 2020 levels by the end of the decade, climate groups argue that pledges are just words on a page without concrete action to make them real. Amid the COP26 talks, the Biden administration unveiled rules aimed at cutting U.S. methane emissions, but critics said they do not go nearly far enough. The United States is the second largest emitter of methane in the world. Julie McNamara, Deputy Policy Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, said in a statement at the time, "For too long, we've known the damaging impacts of this potent heat-trapping pollutant, known that oil and gas operations continue to be a major source of it, and known that solutions to drive rapid reductions across the sector already exist. Yet still, oil and gas operations continue to release untenably high and entirely preventable methane emissions. Swiftly reducing methane emissions will result in significant and much-needed near-term climate progress." Midstream.
What the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, said during his interview with Al Alam channel about activating the air defense system of the resistance was remarkable. Although such threats against the Zionist entity were not new, the capabilities that the resistance now owns in quantity and quality is unparalleled in the history of the resistance and cannot be simply eliminated. There is no doubt that the 2006 war was a very important historical moment for the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah. However, after 2006, martyr commander Imad Mughni said that the time when the entity could wage wars in the way it did in 2006 is long gone. Mind you, in that year, Hezbollah's surprise in the battlefield was the Kornet, where the famous massacre of Merkava tanks in the field of Ikhyam village took place. The resistance has been talking for a while about the many capabilities it possesses, and His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeated several times the term surprises that will happen in any future battle. However, the latest reveal concerning the activation of air risk it will now be taking every time one of its war jets or even spy drones violates Lebanese airspace. What really concerns the Israeli entity is that Hezbollah disclosed air defense systems that it has acquired had succeeded during recent years in delivering them to Lebanon via Syria. It is a massive reveal by military standards, expressed through the operation of these systems in a clear and public manner without concealment, unlike cases in the past. Which indicates troubling intentions and worrying maneuvering trends. Since the vision report, with its remarkable eye, there is confirmation that Hezbollah succeeded in obtaining air defense systems sponsored and facilitated by Syria and Iran, including Russian-made SAM-8 and SAM-17 air defense systems, among others. The systems would threaten and disrupt the activity of the Israeli Air Force violations over Lebanon and aim to shoot down planes on the day of command. In reference to the war, it is estimated, according to the same report, that Hezbollah operatives received practical training on air defense systems inside Syrian territory. Meanwhile, Israeli security officials recently stressed that the Israeli army will not give up what they audaciously referred to as their freedom to operate in the skies of Lebanon to gather intelligence information related to threats, including Hezbollah's missile accuracy project. There's no dispute that Israel's disclosure of new variables of strategic importance related to the growth of Hezbollah's capacity to new levels would eventually bring the resistance closer to its immediate operational position intended to harm the jewel in the crown of the Israeli occupation forces, that is, its air force. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In an unprecedented acknowledgement of doubting the superiority of its own air force in the skies of Lebanon, Israel confirmed that it had received Hezbollah's messages that posed a threat to the Israeli air force and its freedom of movement, putting it in what it referred to as a finger in Israel's eye, with the resistance in Lebanon deliberately revealing air defense systems in its possession. The announcement by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, about the activation of the air defense systems of the resistance sparked a debate inside the Israeli entity about the remaining freedom its air force is capable of having to continue spying over Lebanon or to target Syria from Lebanese airspace. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Abbas Zain, journalist and producer and an expert in the axis of resistance news. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Abbas. Now, Israel has warned of, quote, changing trends, end quote, in the deterrence equation in the Lebanese arena, which would place heavy burdens and maybe uneasy risks on the Israeli occupation's air force, the jewel of the occupation, preventing it from pursuing its violation of Lebanese airspace, as it has been doing for the past four to seven decades, whether with warplanes or drones, knowing the evil that Israel always works with. I am pretty sure that they will not accept this new equation. How do you think they will handle it?
I think that Israel will not accept any disruption to its usual aggression against Lebanon. After the Israeli war on Lebanon in 2006, new deterrence equations were imposed on Israel, which it tried to adapt inside the internal Lebanese arena and in the other arenas throughout the Arab world through the intertwining of the axis of resistance. As you mentioned in your report, Israel will not accept any development that affects that Israel considers it during the course of the Israel-Arab war. So the Israel is one of the weapons that Israel is most interested in while confronting its enemies. Therefore, after 2006, not only at the level of the air defense or the resistance in Lebanon, but at all levels, Israel tried to break any new equation, whether inside or outside the Lebanese arena. For example, Israel's support for the war against Syria and its support of the overthrow of the government of confronting any development in the resistance due to the intertwining between the resistance in Lebanon, the Syrian Arab Army, and Iran as well. On the domestic level as well, the situation in Lebanon falls within the framework of the pressures exerted by Israel for the sake of barter. In the sense of what Sayyid Nasrallah mentioned during his interview with Al Alam TV is not only related to the issue of air defense, he also mentioned that there are pressures being exerted on the other countries concerned with the Lebanese issue. For example, he spoke about the request of Benny Gantz, the Israeli Minister of War, from French President Emmanuel Macron to not submit any assistance to Lebanon except if certain conditions were met. What are the conditions? These conditions relate to the balances of deterrence and the development of capabilities of the resistance. Israel seeks to barter in this file. In short, Israel is trying to prevent these equations and prevent the resistance balance of deterrence from developing on many areas, some of which are security and some are military related to Syria and Lebanon, and others are political and economic by putting pressure on Lebanon and the area in which Hezbollah moves inside Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Abbas,
we did hear Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah saying that, and I quote here, the resistance air defense force has given very effective results since it was activated 2 years ago, reiterating that the resistance considers that it is interested in possessing any weapon that would enable it to defend Lebanon and the people of Lebanon. So it has been activated for the past 2 years. Why announce it now, though? What changed to make it a necessity to publicize the activation, since obviously already Israel knew about Hezbollah having this sort of weapon?
If you want to talk theoretically, in the military and security-wise, the announcement of a specific weapon, especially in conflicts similar to the conflict between the resistance in Lebanon and the Israeli enemy, the announcement of certain armament capabilities means that there is something greater than what was mentioned that is still hidden. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's announcement of the activation of the air defense force without specifying the type of this weapon and how it was activated, left the Israelis with many speculations. But he added that the Israelis do not know how many missiles the resistance has, nor do they know the capabilities of the resistance in particular. The timing of such an announcement, in theory, means that there are more hidden details still unrevealed. Especially since the Israeli media, citing security and military sources in the occupation, has spoken extensively in recent months about the type of specific weapons that Hezbollah possesses related to air defense. Therefore, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah came along to say, yes, we do have air defense weapons, confirming the Israeli reports, but at the same time, leaving the Israelis confused. Yes, Sayyid Nasrallah spoke about air defense, but does the resistance only possess this type of weapon, or does it actually have greater capabilities than what was announced? This is from a security and military view. But there are also those who spoke about the issue being linked to the development of deterrence equations. I mean, Mr. Nasrallah spoke during the interview about something related to Syria. He said that there are still problems in Syria that must be resolved. And I think that he hinted at that time to the Israeli raids, which could be dealt with differently at a certain stage. And this is what the Israeli media took very seriously by noting that it's possible that Hezbollah has already deployed air defense systems on the border with Syria, which might be activated at a later time.
Well, Mr. Abbas, we did also read, according to an Israeli report coming from the Israeli Intelligence Department or division with a very remarkable title that says a finger in the eye of Israel. There is the confirmation that Hezbollah has succeeded in obtaining these weapons, this system of air defense, and it was facilitated by both Syria and Iran, including, the report said, Russian-made S-8, SAM-8, and SAM-17 air defense systems, among others. But could this move be considered one relevant to the entire axis of resistance, or rather just to Hezbollah?
Let us think the same way the Israeli mind thinks, which looks at the region within an intertwined axis. The political, security, and military levels of Israel are talking about an existential threat from Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran, obviously. Any development that affects any faction in the axis of resistance affects all factions. Therefore, Israel deals with the development of the air capabilities of Hezbollah or any party in the resistance axis on the basis that what is happening is related to the resistance axis as a whole, especially since in recent years the fronts have been greatly intertwined, and we have noticed this. And we have noticed this in the Battle of Saif al-Quds, like the indirect interventions through unknown missiles fired from Lebanon and others launched from Syria. Even Iraq entered the equation, and Yemen as well. So the entire axis of resistance is being dealt with on the basis of its formation of an existential threat to the Israeli occupation entity in a homogeneous manner. Therefore, the development of missiles that the Israeli occupation speaks about is not only related to Hezbollah, but it's also related to Syria, Palestine, or Iraq at a later stage. There is also a government in Sana'a that speaks about surprises it is preparing for the occupation entity in Palestine, and so does Iraq.
It remains to be seen what kind of a year this will be for Israel. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Abbas Zain, journalist and producer, expert in the Axis of Resistance News. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Gaza's strong foundation.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the Strong Foundation 2 maneuver conducted by the Palestinian resistance factions in the Gaza Strip during the last days of 2021 is not comparable to the previous exercises in the past years, whether in context, timing, or objectives. Therefore, the messages that it inferred, whether to the enemy or to the friend, were different as well. The resistance, in light of the continuous stumbling in the issues of reconstruction and prisoner swap, which threatens to escalate again, wanted to make sure that the occupation understands that it is ready for any new round and that it operates as a one man's heart in any upcoming standoff. Now, despite the fact that this development occurred weeks ago, but my trip to Tehran to participate in the second anniversary of General Soleimani's martyrdom, followed by covering the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution on the Middle East stream, delayed this truly important development on my show. However, we never forget what our regional resistance does to protect its natives. So here's the second edition of Gaza's Strong Foundation in this following report.
11 military factions participated in the second edition of the Strong Foundation military drills in the besieged Gaza Strip on the last week of 2021. The drills, which continued with live ammunition for days, concluded amid hot battlefield conditions and a political atmosphere fraught with complications, at least in the tense Gaza reconstruction file and the faltering prisoner exchange deal. At the site of the Qassam Martyrs, which extends over hundreds of thousands of meters in the far west of the city of Rafah and the southern Gaza Strip, hundreds of soldiers in uniform and without bandanas to distinguish their party affiliations gathered, led by dozens of military leaders of the resistance factions. One Wednesday afternoon, the field officers stood on a map and model of the field of operations, showing the military leaders the plan for the maneuver and its objectives before asking permission to launch its activities. Orders were as follows. The combat groups of various specializations will carry out a simulation of landing behind enemy lines with the aim of capturing Israeli occupation soldiers. The fire support teams will have to neutralize the dangers that surround them. The military commander gave permission and the intrusion unit began to advance in the field through a previously dug underground tunnel. In the field, three tanks appeared, similar in size and shape to the Israeli Merkava. And in the sky, a drone is trying to thwart the attack. Within a few minutes, the operation began by storming the military base. Then the support units intervened to cover the withdrawal of the resistance fighters who carried a captured soldier on their shoulders. 27 minutes of virtual combat in which combat units trained with live ammunition to use all types of weapons, including heavy machine guns, individual weapons, IEDs, mortars, and RPGs, in addition to improvised explosive devices and grenades. The fighters, who were a mixture of all military arms, showed remarkable harmony and flexibility in the field, which indicates a great progress in the level of field coordination between the military factions. Those factions had joined 3 years ago in a single formation called the Common Room of the Resistance Factions, in whose name Ayman Naufal, commander in the Al-Qassam Brigades, spoke in his first public appearance since he was released in a complex escape from Egyptian prisons in 2011. Naufal said that the strong foundation maneuver sends messages to the enemy and the friend. To the friend, that the resistance has placed the issue of prisoners on the priority list of the joint room of the resistance factions. And to the enemy, that the walls and engineering measures it is taking on the borders of the Gaza Strip will not protect it. The resistance chose to end off 2021 with a number of messages, the most important of which is that the approach of kidnapping Israeli occupation soldiers to liberate the Palestinian prisoners is not up for discussion in the face of the pressure of life requirements in Gaza, and that the exchange deal must take place according to the rules set by the factions, which are prisoners in exchange for soldiers, not soldiers in exchange for reconstruction.
Well, to discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Mr. Ihsan Ataya, representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ihsan. Now, 11 military arms participated in the second edition of the Strong Foundation maneuvers, which continued with live ammunition for days in the besieged Gaza Strip in the last week of 2021. What makes this military drill different than the former ones that Israel seems very concerned about?
Certainly, the military drills that took place in Gaza carried multiple messages in different directions. It was carrying basic messages to the Zionist enemy that the Palestinian resistance is present and ready for any confrontation and ready to achieve more surprises against the Zionist enemy, especially since the Battle of Sword of Al-Quds and the subsequent retraction of the Zionist entity to the terms of the ceasefire and reconstruction, which the Zionist enemy tried to use to punish the Palestinian people in Gaza. In this context, the resistance was able to send some messages that the attempt of the Zionist entity to undermine the achievements of Gaza will fail and cannot be allowed by the resistance, especially since it has attained important achievements and deterrent equations inside Al-Quds at the 1948 territories who rose up in the face of the occupation. This battle was able to mobilize the Palestinian people all over the world. Therefore, military drills are very important because they are an opportunity to test some types of weapons that have not been used in battles before, or in which some technical details are to be tested on the one hand. They are also messages of important morale for the Palestinian people in Gaza. These drills came to say that Gaza is still present, strong and important at the level of the resistance, and also carried a message to the allies of the resistance, saying that Gaza is ready for any decisive battle in which the Axis decides to fight. Gaza will be the spearhead in this battle. Perhaps these drills also carried messages to the normalizing traitors and to those who succumbed to the Zionist entity on the matter of signing agreements with it that would harm the interest of their people and the interest of our nation and the interest of Palestine. Therefore, these drills send many messages calling on these traitors to learn from Gaza. Since Gaza is geographically small, yet it was able to bring the Zionist enemy to its knees and torment its heart, forcing it to find mediators for a ceasefire. Even President Biden himself intervened to achieve that goal. Therefore, the normalizing traitors must understand that this enemy, who they think they are being supported by, will plunder their wealth and will turn their countries into a place of strife and problems.
Well, but Mr. Ataya, it is evident from what you said and from what we saw from these military drills that the resistance in Gaza wants to inaugurate a new character in military action whose title is full partnership with the different factions found in Gaza, not only in the face of the Israeli threat, but in bearing also responsibility of the consequences of any proactive action that this resistance does, as the decision now is to place the liberation of prisoners along with the national red lines for Palestine. So it seems that Gaza is ready to face another aggression to liberate its people from Israeli detention centers. However, will it be able to survive another round of brutal aggression, knowing that the whole world will just turn a blind eye towards Gaza?
One of the messages of these drills was the internal message, as you mentioned, which is training and field interaction among different factions in the event of any upcoming confrontation with the occupation, especially since part of the ceasefire agreement included the issue of the prisoners' swap deal, which the enemy is trying to evade. The issue of prisoners has become a pressing and important issue in this period, especially nowadays, which may cause a real uprising inside the occupied Palestine interior against the Zionist enemy, in solidarity with these people, the prisoners who began to rise up and confront the warden with force. Therefore, these drills carry an important message to the prisoners, saying that Gaza is ready to sacrifice for the sake of liberating these prisoners. In my opinion, any upcoming confrontation, the biggest loser will be the Israeli entity. Even if Gaza bears the greatest losses at the level of buildings, infrastructure, and martyred civilians, but the Zionist enemy is one who avoids confrontation with the Palestinians. The biggest evidence of this is the issue of the Palestinian detainee who went on hunger strike, Hisham Abu Hawash, whose cause the whole world followed, and how the Israeli enemy retreated in this matter due to the threat of the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad movement, who threatened that martyrdom of the prisoner Abu Hawash would be a reason for firing rockets at Tel Aviv and opening a battle in the face of the enemy's military. Therefore, the Zionist enemy is not interested in a military confrontation because it will be the most affected, and because any confrontation will mobilize our people in the West Bank, Al-Quds, and Palestinian interior, and will trigger a serious intifada in its face. In my opinion, the Palestinian people in Gaza have always been accustomed to sacrifice. They are patient, steadfast, and always stationed on an important front in the homeland in Palestine. They have no problem in confronting the occupation and ready at any time to confront this enemy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Ataya, representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. All the support for Gaza and all of Palestine. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Have a great week. We'll be right back.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
A similar fate awaits illegal Zionist regime. In spite of its arsenal of nuclear warheads and over-militarization by the U.S., which will not be able to guarantee for long the existence of the Zionist entity, in the face of the iron resolve of the Palestinian people and the rest of the Ummah for liberation of Beit al-Muqaddas. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Desperate Attempts of Ruthless Regimes to Avert the Inevitable. Stay tuned for more. Desperate indeed are the attempts of repressive regimes to try to stave off their fast approaching end. Of the two ruthless regimes on the brink of extinction, one is miserably self-humiliating and totally alienated from the population, to the extent that it clings to the aprons of others to continue its brutal repression of the people in the vain hope of survival. The other illegal regime has been militarized so dangerously by its godfathers that it may implode any moment, despite its genocide of the sons of the soil and its frequent air raids and missile attacks on neighboring lands. Now these two, after having established natural diplomatic ties, are openly ganging up with each other to savagely suppress the aspirations of freedoms of the people they illegally rule. A couple of months ago, when Palestinian Muslims were being tear-gassed and fired upon by the Zionist troops in the sacred precincts of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Zionist regime's aggressors were being unmanly cheered by Bahraini officials present on the scene and treasonously baying for more Muslim blood. Why? Because if the Palestinians succeed in liberating their usurped land or parts of it, this will bring the day of reckoning nearer for the Al-Khalifa minority regime in Bahrain. And now we have the news that the regime of pirate origin in Manama has appointed an Israeli naval officer for the first time in an Arab state to provide security to it. In a statement recently, the Bahraini foreign minister said the appointment of an Israeli officer is to secure the freedom of navigation in the region, protect international trade, and confront terrorism. What a bizarre statement. Terrorists being asked by terrorists to confront what they view as terrorism against them. The wordings are crystal clear. It means that the overwhelming majority of Bahrain, that is, peacefully demanding democratic rule and restoration of their birthrights, are terrorists. Vice versa, the people of Palestine groaning under the jackboots of the illegal Zionist migrants from Eastern Europe for the past 7 decades and refusing to submit to the usurpers of their homeland are terrorists. Mind-boggling definitions indeed. But would these comrades in crimes against humanity succeed in their bid to prolong their precarious existence? The answer is a big no. Especially when one sees the importance of the U.S. 5th Fleet in Manama and the need for the Zionist regime's naval presence in the Persian Gulf state, which sooner than later will witness the humiliating end of a ruthless and repressive regime. A similar fate awaits illegal Israel, in spite of its arsenal of nuclear warheads and over-militarization by the U.S., which will not be able to guarantee for long the existence of the Zionist entity in the face of the iron resolve of the Palestinian people and the rest of the Ummah for liberation of Beit al-Muqaddas.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Diplomatic missions of Iran and the 5 remaining signatories to the historic Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Britain, France, Russia and China, plus Germany, have been holding talks in Vienna for the past 10 months. The aim has been to revive the Iran nuclear deal and bring the US back to fulfilling its JCPOA obligations. Talks to re-enter the JCPOA began in May 2021 after Joe Biden succeeded Donald Trump as U.S. president and announced his intent to rejoin the nuclear deal. However, political news is indicating that the Biden administration has not yet been able to reach a final decision and consensus on returning to the JCPOA. Joe Biden's bid to revive the Iran nuclear deal is already facing deep skepticism and potential hurdles in the U.S. Congress and even the president's own party. GOP hawks are demanding to have a say and potentially an effective veto power over any attempt to roll back the bevy of illegal sanctions that former President Donald Trump levied on Iranians after illegally withdrawing the U.S. from the 2015 nuclear accord with Iran. Re-entering the JCPOA would almost certainly require the Biden administration to lift the Trump-era sanctions. Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under pretexts irrelevant to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. A source close to the Iranian delegation in the Vienna talks has said that Iran has put many offers on the table to encourage the other side to come up with proposals to resolve outstanding issues. But as Iranian President Raisi has pointed out, the Biden administration is clinging on to the former administration's failed policies, and that's a major obstacle to negotiations proceeding. To further examine the situation, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Tehran wants all sanctions imposed by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump removed and says the issue is its red line. Mr. Zohrevand was ambassador to Afghanistan. A revolutionary himself, he is capable of looking at the system from the outside. He shared his opinion at the studio.
Iran seeks guarantees because of the United States' bad track record. It's a bounce check that the U.S. wrote for Iran. The way they've treated Iran is also alarming. The second point is that Iran has suffered heavy losses over the past 6-7 years. We've practically destroyed the heavy water plant in Iraq. They've destroyed over 10,000 centrifuges. We've lost our workforce. These were all because of the promises the Americans had made.
Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, said a few days ago that there's still fair distance to travel to close the remaining gaps, and those gaps are over what sanctions the United States and other countries will roll back in exchange for restrictions on Tehran's nuclear program. The eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the landmark 2015 nuclear deal took place in Vienna, where Iran is still looking for guarantees the U.S. sanctions will be lifted. International media present in the Austrian capital to cover the negotiations report that the three working groups on sanctions removal, nuclear issues, and sequencing the implementation of a probable agreement met on Friday, February the 11th, to work on the remaining outstanding issues. Mr. Bahonar was once deputy speaker for parliament. We met him at his office in town, where he squeezed in an interview.
Based on the latest developments in Vienna, I know that discussions over the technical issues are already over and a text is drafted. It's now up to the U.S. to make up its mind. Washington is facing many problems, including internal struggles between the Democrats, Republicans, and even the president's aides. We've seen that the current and former U.S. presidents are practically joining forces to damage what's left of the United States' reputation. We don't object to anything. We have said that if all sides return to the agreement and provide guarantees that the non-compliance won't repeat, we are willing to return to full compliance with the JCPOA.
Iran's Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian told Al Jazeera that lifting sanctions means lifting all forms of sanctions stipulated in the nuclear agreement. The sanctions that Trump reimposed contradict the terms of the agreement. We demand guarantees that include not imposing any new sanctions and not reimposing sanctions after lifting them under any pretext, he added. The most important issue in the Vienna talks is verification, according to the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. That's to say, America has to lift sanctions off Iran altogether, and Iran must get to verify that those sanctions have been lifted off this country correctly. Only then will Iran return to its JCPOA commitments. That's its definite policy, and it won't go back on it. Iran's argument for the need to verify the compliance of other parties with their JCPOA obligations has roots in its experience in the pre- and post-JCPOA periods. The IAEA had the authority to verify Iran's activities, and at first it did verify Iran's compliance with precise technical and measurable standards. But when the JCPOA came into force and sanctions began to be lifted, there was no authority to verify their removal.
My personal analysis is that the Americans are trying to buy time because the JCPOA isn't the only issue they're concerned about. Iran's nuclear activities aren't that important for the U.S. despite all the fuss they're kicking up. The more significant issue for them is Iran's regional influence and deterrence power. They're now at delicate positions both in the South China Sea in the Pacific and in Ukraine. They're waiting to see what happens to decide whether or not to return to the JCPOA.
The meticulous verification by the IAEA regarding Iran's nuclear program continued for 2.5 years after the JCPOA's execution and up to a year after the U.S. withdrawal in May 2018, during which the IAEA confirmed Iran's compliance 16 times in its quarterly reports. According to international observers, however, the United States and European countries were not lifting sanctions against Iran and resolving barriers to the normalization of its international trade relations in an effective and practical manner, as required by the JCPOA. In the meantime, Iran's complaints went unheard, even though it repeatedly insisted that its trade relations had not returned to normal and that it had not reaped the anticipated economic benefits from lifting sanctions during the period from January 2016 through May 2018. Mr. Davoudi is National TV's Foreign News General Manager with an eye for the fine print. He joined us at Press TV Studios.
The United States' foreign and domestic policies can be described by two adjectives. The country is desperate in its foreign policy and is witnessing a chaotic domestic policy. We're facing a country that isn't aware of what's happening to it. It's withdrawn its forces from the background base in Afghanistan and is leaving Iraq too. We're facing a country that couldn't establish its foothold in the region despite everything that happened. We're facing a United States in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic, the death of George Floyd, the 22 presidential race, and the January 6th Capitol attack.
Finally, in May 2019, after a year of strategic patience, Iran decided to roll back some of the restrictions on its nuclear energy program by resorting to its rights under the JCPOA. The JCPOA grants a party the right to suspend its contractual commitments in case of non-performance by the other party. During recent Vienna talks, little progress was made on the two main issues of verifying the removal of sanctions and guarantees that the United States would not withdraw from the JCPOA again. Some media reports suggested that the U.S. delegation had agreed with Iran's demand to verify the removal of sanctions in 2 days. But Iran said this would not actually be accepted and it was a mere formality.
Whether or not the JCPOA is revived, we're carrying on our own path. We've been able to turn sanctions into opportunities. Our capacities have increased since Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA. Our economic capacity is incomparable with our geopolitical capacities. Our geopolitical capacities compare quite favorably with that of Russia, China, and the U.S. We shouldn't forget this fact. Our GDP, of course, doesn't bear comparison with theirs, but our geopolitical situation can make up for the smaller GDP. Therefore, we're the winners if the Americans decide not to return to the 2015 deal.
In fact, if the JCPOA is revived, Iranian parliament will require regular verification of the removal of sanctions. In a statement they've issued, Iranian lawmakers have said that the continued benefit to Iran's economy from the lifting of sanctions had to be verified over a six-month period. According to them, during this period, Iran needs to return its oil production and exports to pre-sanction levels, have free access to its revenues, and normalize its banking relations with the world.
The U.S. hasn't removed any sanctions. They're saying they've granted sanctions waivers that are related to non-proliferation and nuclear safety, something that the Americans are concerned about. That's because they want to achieve a higher level of inspections of Iran's nuclear sites. What they've announced didn't benefit us. We want them to remove sanctions on our oil sales and dollar-based transactions and insurance. We want them to drop the pressure they're exerting on our allies. These are what we are following up on as examples of sanctions removal and not the issues that they will ultimately benefit from.
Also, another important issue for the Islamic Republic when it comes to verifying the removal of sanctions and U.S. compliance with the JCPOA commitments is how Washington will honor its obligations under the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. According to this resolution, the arms embargo on Iran should have been lifted on October 18, 2020. For Iran, what matters most is the cancellation of former President Trump's September 2020 executive order, according to which the U.S. government punishes any country that does not abide by its sanctions. Tehran considers this to be a blatant violation of Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA, and its cancellation will serve as a serious indication of Washington's intention to fulfill its obligations.
In our view, a good deal is one under which both the Americans and the Europeans agree that they need to fully respect the Iranian people's rights and the Islamic Republic of Iran's interests. We respect everyone. We haven't invaded anywhere in the world. We don't recognize any foreign land as our own. We haven't taken our troops to a foreign country to build a military base there and design military facilities on the top of our embassies. This means that we are showing our respect. Therefore, a good agreement, in our view, is one that would satisfy us, the other side, and the ones linked to us. But a point to consider here is that our definition of the word satisfaction is completely different from that of the United States. We define winning as what I just mentioned, but the Americans' definition of winning is to end Iran.
A short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Plenty more of our narrative coming up, but first let's take a look at other media outlets together to see what others have to say. And here's how other outlets have put it in words. In sounding Iran's unwavering concerns, Mehr News reads, Iran seeks guarantee of no sanctions after change in U.S. administration. If the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, is revived, Iran will need a guarantee that sanctions will not return with change in the U.S. government, Iranian ambassador to Russia, Kazem Jalali, said. We have a poor experience with the Western approach to the JCPOA. The Americans have changed government and they have violated their obligations under the JCPOA. Therefore, the people of Iran have a right to know about future guarantees so that sanctions will not be reimposed again, the Iranian ambassador Jalali told Sputnik. He also said that sanctions were essentially a form of oppression against the Iranian people, which is why such guarantees are necessary. The European Council on Foreign Relations notes Iran's indignation. Fool me once, how Tehran views the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the U.S. should focus their efforts on swiftly returning to the original nuclear agreement with Iran rather than holding out for the unlikely prospect of better terms. In Tehran, the initial hopes for what the Biden administration could offer Iran, particularly in terms of a revived economy, are fading. Iranian leaders realize that although the new president in the White House says he wants to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal, there has been little tangible shift away from the Trump-era maximum pressure campaign against Iran. While there is still a possibility that the agreement will be revived, it is increasingly appearing to Tehran that the process will be a marathon and not a sprint. It is often difficult to find a consensus between Iranian leaders on the benefits of diplomacy with the West, but there is one point on which they agree. Tehran must end its strategic patience in the implementation of the nuclear deal. The rhetoric for public consumption varies between different camps in Iran, who differ on the extent and method of the response. However, political elites now generally agree that Iran should not allow itself to be duped by the United States again, and that Tehran should not reverse any steps to accelerate its nuclear program until Washington is certain to ease sanctions in return. Modern diplomacy focuses on internal U.S. power struggles. USA-Iran, why is the deal stalled? The debate within the United States itself promises to be difficult. On the surface, it seems that the U.S. president has the authority to lift sanctions immediately. President Trump resumed applying the restrictive measures by executive order. Such a decree can be cancelled or modified either by a new executive order or via a new law that could be passed by Congress. That is, technically, Biden has the authority to ease sanctions on a large scale. However, in reality, the situation is more complicated. In 2015, Congress passed the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. In the event of a deal, the president is required to inform Congress every 90 days of its progress and certify that Iran is adhering to the terms of the deal. Obviously, under current conditions, such certification in favor of Iran is simply impossible. This means that Biden cannot agree to the lifting of sanctions without the risk of serious losses of his political capital. In other words, Tehran's requests are unacceptable for the U.S. president. However, even if a new deal is reached, its stability is not guaranteed. That'll be it for the news section. We can return to our narrative now. Biden's European allies maintain that the current obscurity surrounding a U.S. return to the nuclear pact isn't the president's fault. Rather, they argue, Trump made Biden's task impossible when he went beyond withdrawal from the 2015 deal and imposed brand new sanctions that were unrelated to Iran's nuclear program. Sanctions that Tehran has demanded must be nullified now and once and for all.
Mr. Biden is facing domestic challenges stemming from the unprecedented bipolar political environment that began under former President Trump. Both the Republicans and Democrats are actively opposing the JCPOA. Mr. Ted Cruz in the Republican Party has the same position about the deal as Mr. Menendez of the Democratic Party. They're not willing to pass the JCPOA in Congress, but say they need to review the deal. This shows the Americans are stalling for time to see what happens.
Another challenge that the Biden administration is facing as it tries to revive the 2015 nuclear deal is Tehran's firm demand that the U.S. provide a guarantee that it won't again quit the pact and reimpose sanctions, diplomats in Austria say. According to U.S. and European missions, the demand, a reaction to Donald Trump's irrational withdrawal from the deal, appears to be a paramount political objective for the government of Iran. The U.S. has consistently taken the position that no president can legally tie the hands of a successor without a treaty that would need to get the backing of two-thirds of U.S. Senate. Ironically, a group of GOP senators recently unveiled legislation aimed at preventing Biden from rejoining the nuclear deal. The bill would ensure that any new agreement the president reaches takes the form of a treaty, thereby requiring congressional approval. If they don't do it as a treaty, then it's just a political agreement that is only as good as the current administration, Senator Rubio said. It could be changed by a future administration. Iran's expectation of a permanent U.S. commitment to a deal highlights the concern the 2015 nuclear deal was never actually signed as a deal and treaty with clear-cut legal guarantees. Its name, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is testament to the fact that it was a bunch of political commitments, although it was later backed by a UN Security Council resolution. The standoff over guarantees comes amid what U.S. and European officials say are signs of progress in the eighth round of Vienna talks. There has been progress on the fine print, including how sanctions would be lifted, how Iran will scale back its nuclear work, and how a deal might be implemented over several months. However, Western diplomats are concerned that the window for talks is closing, given the fast advances in Iran's nuclear work.
Based on international principles and religious obligations, Iran has completely carried out its obligations. You can take a look at the deal's articles. It is also backed up by numerous IAEA reports and those that have been read at the UN Security Council meetings. The Fourth Islamic Republic of Iran has fulfilled its obligations and is known to everyone. But the point is that exactly when Iran completed its obligations and it was time for the U.S.